The title of our message today is the exact same as the title of the message last week, only we've added in a part two at the end of it. So the title today is Life Isn't Fair, or is it? We learned at a very young age that life isn't fair, didn't we? There's something about kids. Kids see equity and they see inequity. Kids see when, if you ever want to freak your kids out, then when you're giving them ice cream, give one of them significantly more. In fact, you don't even need to give one of them significantly more. Just give one of them a little more. Just make it noticeable. Even a glass of milk. Pour a glass of milk and then do the other one a little higher. Let them watch you do it and then give one of them the one with more in it. How come they got more milk than I did? They might not even like milk, but they're all of a sudden concerned that one of them got more than the other one. And it's not about how much milk they got. It's about the fact that one of them got more milk than the other one. It's not about how much milk they wanted. It's about the fact that somebody got treated differently than them. And so we learn early in life that life isn't fair. And when someone complains today, we have a saying that we say to them, and it's a good saying. Someone will start to complain about something and we'll say to them, "Didn't your mom ever teach you that life isn't fair?" And our mom did teach us that life isn't fair, didn't she? And life is not fair, but God is the great equalizer. In fact, that's a title that I kind of played around with a little bit for this study. God, the great equalizer. God is able to take a life that looks like it's not really been blessed at all, and he's able to turn it upside down and use it for his glory. Some people struggle their entire life. Some people are born in poverty and never get out of it. Some people are born with a condition and deal with that condition their entire lives. Some people seem to, as my mom would have said, some people seem to be snake bit. They just go from one struggle to another struggle to another struggle to another struggle, and they never seem to really be able to pull it together. But here's what our God does. In our weaknesses, he is strong. God uses our sufferings. God uses our struggles. God takes us where we are and the life that we have been given, and he lifts us up and he uses us in a way that we never thought could be done. God's able to do it too with someone that's born with a silver spoon in their mouth, someone that never seems to have any struggles, someone that seemed to have ease their whole lives. If they will surrender themselves to him, God will use them as well. But here's the thing about God and his equalizing and his rewards. First of all, I don't know that I understand heavenly rewards. Over the years, I've had opportunity to teach on rewards. There's certain passages that talk about rewards, like the one in Corinthians that talks about the wood, hay, and stubble, and how some of that is burnt up, and there's rewards that remain. There's the jewels that remain. Jesus said, don't stack up treasure here on earth, but stack it up in heaven. We're told that we're going to get crowns for faithfulness and crowns for, if you are martyred for Christ, you receive a crown. So I know we receive rewards, but rewards, awards, and treasures are very earthly things that are speaking of something that is very heavenly. How does it work in heaven? What do? Do I walk into a room in my mansion that God's prepared for me and there's a big treasure laying there, gold and silver and jewels, and I just roll around in it for eternity? I've got my rewards. This is awesome. Throw it in the air. Oh, I love the sound of money. Oh, I love the sound of silver and gold. This is great. Do we put our awards up on a mantle in a fireplace in our mansion? You want to come over and see the awards that I got? Do we wear our crowns all around heaven? This is the crown I received. This is, or maybe badges on our jackets. This is the badges that I've received. Well, obviously, that's not what's going to happen in heaven, right? We are going to receive rewards. I just don't know how they're going to be divvied out there. When we think about rewards, we think that people that are used by God in great ways are going to receive great rewards. We think of Billy Graham, that there's Main Street in heaven, and it's paved in gold, and down next to the throne of God is Billy Graham's mansion. It's a huge mansion. It's just amazing. Next to D.L. Moody's mansion. Next to Martin Luther's mansion, right? Got all these mansions. And you finally get over to a travel trailer and you go, what's that? Robert Furrow. He gets a travel trailer for all of eternity. I don't know that that's the way it works. Jesus, when he looked at people giving offerings, He saw some people giving great amounts, but he saw a poor widow come and give 2 cents. And then he said this, that widow gave more than any of the rest because she gave everything she had and they gave out of their reserves. Could it be that if you are just faithful with what God's called you, that you will receive as many rewards in heaven as Billy Graham did being faithful with what God had called him to do? Could it be that God equalizes those rewards? Wasn't that the story we learned last week of the day laborers? Some worked through the heat of the day and received a denarius, and some worked for an hour and received a denarius, and the people that worked through the heat of the day were upset. Not because they had received anything unfair, not because a denarius wasn't fair, but they were upset that somebody else got the same wage that they did, even though they worked more. And could it be that you are saying to God now, you're not using me, you can't use me, who am I, I'm not doing much for you. And God is saying, who are you? You're my child. I filled you with the Spirit. Out of you gush torrents of living water, and people are being touched, and you don't even know what's going on around you. But the enemy whispers in your ear, you can't be used. You're not being used by God. And we go, oh yeah, I'm not being used by God. God said in our weaknesses, he is strong. In our weaknesses, he is strong. In your weaknesses, he is strong. God does powerful things through your weaknesses. I think when we get to heaven, we're going to look back at what God has done through our life, and we're going to think, I wish I would have understood that. I'd have been more faithful with what God's given me. That's really what it's about. It's not about trying to be used by God in a greater way than someone else. It's about being faithful with what God's given you. It's about being a good steward of what God has placed upon you. So right after this story of this equity, the day laborers, Jesus begins to head to Jerusalem. Look at verse 17. And don't miss the significance of this. Now, Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples aside on the road and said to them, this is the end. It's hard to believe we're in chapter 20 of Matthew, and we've only got a week of the life of Jesus left. We've covered 3 years of his ministry up until now, and now we've just got a week left. We've been 2 years in the first 20 chapters. We'll probably be 2 years in the last 8 chapters because it's more intensified in those last 8 chapters. I don't know how long it will take us for real, but it's going to take us a while. But this is the end. He's marching with his disciples. One of the Gospels say that Jesus walked with his disciples towards Jerusalem and walked in front of them. Like a general leading his troops, Jesus was in front of the disciples, leading them to Jerusalem as he was ready to die there. And he tells them what's going to happen. He says in verse 18, behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priest and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. Did you notice the word betrayed? Who's he talking to? The 12 disciples. Who's one of the 12 disciples? Judas. I wonder if Jesus looked at Judas when he said betrayed. You ever been talking to a group of people and you talk about an individual in that group and you can't help but look at them? You're like talking about him, you look at them and talk about them. And I wonder if Jesus said, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed. And I wonder if he looked at Judas. And I wonder what Judas thought. I still don't know that I understand all of what was going on inside of Judas or what the whole betrayal was all about from Judas's perspective. But Judas was going to betray him, and it didn't happen by accident. Some people believe that Jesus made his way to Jerusalem and just kind of got out of control and got himself crucified. Before he ever got there, he said, the Son of Man will be betrayed and he will be condemned to death. Look at verse 19. And deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify. And on the third day, he will rise again. Now, they didn't get it. And I don't really blame them for not getting it. You might say, this isn't the first time Jesus told them this. He tells them this on several occasions. I'm going to Jerusalem and I'm going to die. Peter takes him aside one time and says, Lord, may it never be that you even speak this way. And Jesus rebukes, get behind me, Satan, he says to Peter. But Jesus often talked to them in parables. He often said things in ways that they didn't understand them. Later on, they would say to him when they were alone, what did you mean by this? I don't get it. I don't know what you were talking about. So when Jesus said the Son of Man is going to condemned to death, scourged, and crucified, and raised on the third day, they probably thought, I wonder what that means. They didn't know he was talking plainly. It wasn't until after the resurrection that they went, that's exactly what he said. It happened just like he said it did. but Jesus often talked in parables, so I'm not down on them for not getting it. But Jesus is saying to them, the Son of Man is going to go suffer, and the greatest work that would ever be done would be through suffering. And here we find the first aspect of God being the great equalizer. You might be in the midst of suffering today. Others of you may not have suffered for a long time. The interesting thing about life is that life turns on a dime. Life seems to march in one direction for such a long time, and then all of a sudden seems to shift. And for us who are Christians, we wonder, why am I suffering? Why am I going through this? But God can use your suffering. I'm not only going to say God can use your suffering, I'm going to say God will use your suffering. I know when I have suffered that I have prayed, God, use this. If I'm going to go through this, then I want my suffering to be for your glory. But I'm not like Paul. Paul actually prayed for suffering. Paul knew that suffering could be used by God, that the world was upside down in the kingdom of God, and that God actually uses suffering for his glory. So Paul said, Lord, I want to know you in the power of your resurrection and in the fellowship of your suffering. I've never prayed, God, make me suffer. Bring suffering into my life for your glory. And in fact, I generally pray, let the rest of my life be really easy, Lord. I think I've suffered enough, but whatever suffering I have, I want to use for your glory. And this is a point of encouragement to those of you right now that are suffering. There's something going on in your life. It's taken a turn that you haven't expected. Maybe your whole life changed on one day, and you now don't know what's going on and what's happening. God will use this for his glory. If he used suffering to do the greatest work that he could ever be done in the cross, in salvation, in the forgiveness of sins, then what makes you think that he won't use suffering in our lives? God uses suffering. And if somehow you don't believe that, or if you've been listening to some preacher on the TV who tells you God didn't want you to suffer at all, then read 1 Peter. I think you can trust Peter more in 1 Peter than you can trust some preacher on TV that tells you God doesn't want you to suffer. Peter says in 1 Peter, I want my sufferings to bring glory to God, because he knows that God can use them. God is the great equalizer. And if you're one that finds a silver spoon in your mouth, if you're one that finds you have health your whole life and you die in your sleep and you never really suffer or struggle, then you need to pray that God would use that for his glory. That somehow God would use that. Thank him that you don't have that great suffering, but pray that somehow God would use it. Because a line in a Johnny Cash song, of all people, Johnny Cash wrote a song called When the Man Comes Around. You ever heard the song? He quotes scripture in the beginning and the end of it. It's about the return of Jesus Christ. And at one point he says, not everybody will be treated just the same. That's the truth. Not everybody is treated just the same. God treats us all differently. But God uses wherever we are for his glory. So the first thing that we learn is that God treats us fairly in our suffering. Even though we may suffer now and feel like it's unfair, God uses it. Well, right after he talks about this great suffering, look at verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons, who is Zebedee's sons, by the way? James and John, right? Who are James and John? They're two of the inner circle. Out of the 12 disciples, Jesus took three of them and gave them a special place, Peter, James, and John. So the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to him with their sons kneeling down and asking something from them. She comes before Jesus and she kneels down on the ground before him and she says, I want you to do something for me. We know from the other gospels that's how she worded it. It's like your kids, when your kids come and say, Mom, I want to ask you something, but I want you to say yes before I ask it. Like that ever works. Or like my kids who would try to manipulate me. Maybe I did it to my mom as well. I want to ask you something, but you always say no. I would ask you something, Dad, but you always say no. Like that's going to make me say, sure, go ahead, go jump off a 10-story building. It's fine with me. Because you manipulated me before by saying that I always say no. If you didn't ask me for things that are bizarre, I wouldn't say no all the time. That's what she does. She tries to come to him and say, will you give me this? Something that you don't even know you're going to do for me? But Jesus kind of, he knows what's going on. So Jesus says to her in verse 21, what do you wish? And she said to him, grant that my two sons, that the two sons of mine, these are good boys, they're good Jewish boys, James and John, grant that they may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your kingdom. She doesn't go and pray, Lord, use my sons to the best of their ability. Bless them and use them in your kingdom. She, in essence, says, my boys have an opportunity to be in on the ground floor. They have an opportunity to be in where they can be used by God and be at the right or the left hand of the kingdom of God. It'd be like today being able to be in on the ground floor of Apple in the very beginning. Apple is, they have more money than some countries have. If you could have been down in the ground floor of that, imagine being in on the ground floor of the kingdom of heaven. And again, it's not about where they're at. It's about them being above other people. This is selfish ambition. It's not about being used by God. It's about being the top dog in the kingdom. Let us sit on your right and left hand. And when we see this kind of selfish ambition, it's a bit offensive. But this is James and John. And we generally think about James and John as being, well, James eventually is going to be a martyr for Jesus. He'll give his life 10 years after Jesus dies. He'll give his life. And John will suffer as well. And we think of John as the guy who wrote the book of Revelation, wrote the books of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. John wrote the book of John. And here they are wanting to be the top dogs. I mean, they're the ones that brought their mom in on this whole thing. And so they ask this question. Look here at, look at verse 22. Jesus answered and said to them, you do not know what you ask. Now, I want you to notice that he bypasses their mom and he goes straight to James and John. Because this is James and John putting their mom up to this. Now, their mom might have just gone along with it. In fact, she might have told them when they were talking about, we really want to be greatest in the kingdom and we think we are greatest. We're certainly better than Peter. Peter thinks he's the greatest, but he's not the greatest. We're the greatest. And she might have very well said, I can help you with this. You want me to go to Jesus and ask him? Has your mom ever done that to you? Start talking about your school or something that's going on that's not fair. You want me to go talk to your teacher? No, mom, no. Do not want you to go talk to you. I'll take care of it. I'll straighten it out. How about your coach? Your mom and dad ever said she'd get involved with your coach? Your coach benches you and you feel like it's unfair. And your mom says, you want me to talk to your coach? No, mom, please don't talk to my coach, please. Anything but talk to my coach. And so Jesus turns to the guys now because it's not really the mother. That's the issue here. It's them. They want to be the greatest. And Jesus says to them, do you know what you ask? You know what the answer to that is? They don't have a clue. They should have, because they just heard Jesus talk about being condemned to death and being crucified, but they don't have a clue. Do you know what you ask? Are you able to drink of the cup that I am about to drink? Jesus didn't even want to drink that cup. Remember in the garden when the weight of suffering and grief was placed upon him? Do you remember that Jesus prayed 3 times? Lord, if there's any other way, take this cup from me. Jesus didn't want to drink it. And he says to them, are you able to drink the cup that I'm going to drink? Look at their response. And be baptized, he said, in the baptism that I'm about to be baptized with. By the way, what a baptism that is. Baptism of suffering, a baptism of pain, a baptism of crucifixion, a baptism of being scourged. They said to him, we are able. We hear James and John. Now, it's not the mom answering. Now, it's James and John going, yeah, we want to sit in your right and left hand. And if that's what it takes, we're able. And we all know what Jesus is going to go through. And we go, no, 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 you're not able. So he said to them, verse 23, you will indeed drink of my cup. James would be the first of the disciples to be martyred. 10 years after the life of Jesus, James was killed by Herod with a sword. And we wonder, why pour all of that into James? Why let him be one of the inner circle? Why let him be one of the leaders and then have him be one of the first ones to die? And why his brother of all people, his younger brother, why will he be the last one to die? Here we got 2 brothers. One of them is the first to die and one of them is the last to die. Not everybody will be treated all the same. And which one had the better part, by the way? The one that died as a martyr or the one that lived for Christ older than anyone else? He became known as the younger, who lived until the end, or the longer than any other disciple. He became known as the elder because he became so old, people just started calling him the old guy. It's the old guy. But everybody was excited to see John because John had been with Jesus. And John was arrested by Rome when he was older, and they boiled him in oil. That's, by the way, another word for that is fried, right? They heated up oil and they placed him in oil. Can you imagine? We're able. Yeah, we can be baptized in the baptism. I wonder if John thought about that in the pain of being boiled in oil. And then the Bible, our history tells us that he survived and was exiled to the island of Patmos. But can you imagine surviving and having to heal from those third-degree burns that would have been all over his body after being boiled in oil? We probably don't even want to think about it too much. It is so brutal. Jesus said, you will indeed be baptized in the baptism that I'll be baptized in. But then he goes on to say, in verse 23, but to sit at my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give, but it's those whom is prepared for them by my Father. See, again, for James and John, it was not about being used by God or being the most effective they could be in what they'd been given. It's not about being good stewards. It's about getting above other people. There's a fine line between selfish ambition and stewardship. We want to be good stewards. We want to take what God's given us, and we want to be good stewards. God has allowed me or called me to be the pastor of Calvary Chapel of Tucson, and I want this church to do the best that it can possibly do. I want us to faithfully call people and see people saved. I want us to be good stewards. That's a good thing. It's a bad thing when I start saying, I want this Calvary Chapel to be better than any other Calvary Chapel anywhere. I want us, this church, to become the biggest church that there's ever been in all of the nation. I want us to be known as a strong, I want us to have that, because it's a connection of trying to get us above someone else. Instead of just saying, you know what, Lord, I just want to be faithful. I just want to use it, use us. We've planted some churches and cities, and we've noticed that when we plant churches in cities that other pastors in those towns get upset. They get upset because they say, we've already got this town covered. They live in a town of 1.5 million people. They've got a church of 300 people, and they say, we don't need no more churches here. What are you doing here? Listen, if you live in a town of 1 million people and you have 10,000 people, 10,000 members, you're just a fraction of a percent. You haven't reached that town for Jesus, even if you have a church that's 10,000 people. There needs to be more people that preach the gospel, more people who teach the Bible. There needs to be more churches. But here's the fear. The fear is that if somebody plants a church, then it might get bigger than my church. And if it gets bigger than my church, then what does that say? I'm the king of the hill. I'm the one on top. I'm the top dog. I don't want anybody else to come here and become the top dog, become that person. That's selfish ambition. Jesus says to them, you're able to be baptized in what I'm baptized in, and you will be. Now, when the other disciples heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. The other disciples are upset. The 10 disciples hear it, and they go, I can't believe James and John brought their mama. Could you imagine hearing them talk? We don't think about the disciples in that way, but you know they did. Do you believe that? Your mom went and asked for James and John to be the ones who would sit on the right, left-hand side of the kingdom. Now, they weren't upset because they saw the selfish ambition in James and John. They were upset that they didn't think about it. They were upset that they didn't do it. Oh, man, what a good idea. I should have brought my mom in. She could have asked Jesus. So Jesus has to reset their button here. He has to reset their, he's told them so often, it's not about being great. It's about being a servant. But selfishness, it's like our reset button. We can learn it. We can say, I'm not going to be selfish anymore. We live a little bit. Whoop, reset button is hit, we're selfish again. And it happens over and over again. And I could just see Jesus going, come here, guys, sit down. I got to tell you this again. He would do it again, by the way, after this. But Jesus called them to himself, verse 25. You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. That's the world. Hey, how are people who are CEOs of companies treated? How are people that are in charge? How are generals treated? They exercise authority. But that's not the way it's supposed to be in the kingdom. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be a servant. Serve people. Serve the people around you. Serve your family. Serve your friends. Let people in front of you when they turn on your turn signal and want to get in front of you. That's practical. And when you are called into a position of authority or leadership, then know it's servanthood. Verse 27, whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Interesting choice of words. In a culture where slavery exists, Rome, and in a culture where slaves are abused, he says, if you want to be great, you want to be first, then be a slave. Take that role as a servant. Take that role as a slave. Give up your rights. That's faith. That's living by faith, because then God's got to come in and intercede. Then God's got to be the one that does the work. He goes on to say in verse 28, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. At the end of this week, he will put on a towel, get up from the Last Supper table and wash the disciples' feet and say, what have I done for you? You call me Lord and Master, and you do so rightfully because I am. And if I have washed your feet, then you need to wash one another's feet. He tries to get them to get to the place of servanthood. It's not about climbing over other people. It's about being a steward to what God's given you. God may call you to do some great work. You got to be a steward of it. Someone like a Billy Graham or someone like a Charles Swindoll, they've been given 10 talents. They have a lot of talents. You say, well, I haven't been given those talents. That's not the call in my life. That doesn't mean you don't need to be a good steward. You still have to run your race. You still have to be a good steward of what you've been given. You have to be a servant where you are, just as they have to be a servant. In the end, you might have the better part, like the woman who put the 2 cents in. She was able to give everything to God. In the end, you might have the better part, but you want to be faithful with what God's given you, a good steward, not trying to climb a ladder, but just trying to say, I just want to be faithful. I just want to take the talents you've given me, and I want to be faithful with those talents. I want to give it back to you. Now, this chapter ends, and it's interesting the way it ends. It ends with two blind men receiving their sight. Matthew's the only one who tells us that there's two of them. And I think it's because Matthew is contrasting them. He's contrasting them to James and John. You have two blind men that came to Jesus, and they were named James and John. We want to be great in the kingdom. And Jesus is like, you guys are still blind. You've been with me for 3 years, and you're still just concerned about yourself. Now there's two blind men that come to Jesus in verse 29. Now they went out of Jericho, and a great multitude followed them. And behold, two blind men sitting by the road, when they heard that Jesus was passing by, cried out, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David. Now, Jesus has been going back and forth from Galilee to Jerusalem, over to Tyre and Sidon, up into the very high northern regions of Caesarea Philippi for 3 years. I don't know how these blind guys missed Jesus for those 3 years, but Jesus has been healing blind people and lepers for that whole time. And I'm sure that they, during this time, have heard about Jesus and his miracles. And they've said, if ever we see him, we're going to cry out. The word for cry out here is used in another place to speak of a lunatic crying out. They all of a sudden started to cry out. But look at the way the crowds treat him. Verse 31, then the multitude warned them, saying that they should be quiet. Now, what does it mean? The multitude warned them in saying that they should be quiet. The multitude went over and went, be quiet. Why, yada. To a blind guy, to two blind guys. How'd they warn him? Shut up or we're going to smack you. You guys be quiet or else we'll run you off. Why'd they treat blind people that way? Because in their day, they believed that if you were blind, if you had any sickness, they believed it was your fault. There are people that believe that today. There are books that you can go out and buy that'll tell you if you have any kind of sickness or struggle or condition, that's because there's sin in your life or that you don't have enough faith. Same thing. Remember in John, the disciples asked Jesus about a blind man who was born from birth, blind from birth. They said, who sinned that this man would be born blind? See their connection? Who sinned that this man would be born blind? Was it him or his parents? They thought somehow that guy sinned in their mother's womb. They didn't believe in reincarnation, so they had to believe that that guy sinned in his mother's womb, that God would cause him to be born blind. So when these guys start crying out, they're like, look at you guys, you sinners, you blind guys. You wouldn't be blind if it wasn't for some sin in your life, and so you be quiet. And they warned them, but they cried out all the more. Look at verse 31. Then the multitudes warned them that they should be quiet, but they cried out all the more, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David. No matter what people think, you should cry out to God. Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David. Notice they ask for mercy, they call him Lord, and they call him the Messiah. That's the Son of David. The reference to Son of David is the reference to being the Messiah. Doesn't matter what people think. These guys, what did it matter to them if they could get a hold of Jesus? Now, these two blind guys are like, remember the story of the day laborers. James and John are the ones that work through the heat of the day. They worked all 12 hours. These two blind guys come in the very end, and they call out to the Lord. And I love in verse 32 that Jesus stood still. Doesn't say Jesus went to him. It says Jesus stood still and called out and said, what do you want me to do for you? The blind people could have said, isn't it obvious? You really need to ask that question? What do you want me? We're two blind guys screaming out to you to have mercy on us. What do you think we want you to do? But Jesus wanted them to ask, what do you want me to do for you? And they said to him, Lord, that our eyes would be opened. And Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes. And immediately their eyes received sight and they followed him. Now, I believe that these two blind guys became Christians. I could be wrong about that. But one of the other gospels tells us one of their names. His name was Bartimaeus. We call him blind Bartimaeus. One of these guys that sat and cried out is blind Bartimaeus. And I think that later on, I think it's Mark that gives us his name. I think that Mark gives us his name because he was involved in the early church. It's as if he was saying, and then Bartimaeus called out to him. And you guys know Bartimaeus. He's here among us. He's part of us. Jesus is giving us an example again. Here are these guys and they're blind. They're thought of as being the outcasts of society. Crowds are even have a lack of compassion on them that when a healer comes by, they tell them to be quiet and not to bother Jesus at all. And God exalts them and lifts them up, heals them and exalts them. That's God. He is the great equalizer. He's able to come in wherever we are because we've learned to live and to understand that life isn't fair. When we're at a restaurant and they bring our ice cream out and the person we're with got more than us, we just go, of course. It's the way life is. People always get more ice cream than me. We've learned to accept it. But God is still the great equalizer. And God will use your life no matter who you are, no matter what you've done. If you are a believer, you've been filled with the Spirit, you've been called by Him, and God will honor that. And even though I don't understand rewards, maybe you understand it better. I don't understand how those rewards are going to work in heaven. I don't understand exactly what he's trying to tell us we're going to get by stacking up treasure in heaven. I know it's an analogy. I just don't understand exactly what it's going to mean when we get there. But I know as I want it. I know I want to stack up treasure in heaven. I want the crown that I can throw at the feet of Jesus. I want the rewards. I don't know what it's going to be, but I want them. And we all have the same opportunity. It's not just a pastor that has an opportunity to have those rewards, but we all have the same opportunity to live for him because God's the great equalizer. Stand with me, would you, and let's pray together.